KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Onion Music Festival starting July 28th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space in Washougal, Washington. The Onion Music Festival features a three-day lineup of musicians, artists, installations, and vendors. Performers include the fabulous Downey Brothers, The Fur Coat, Night Heron, Adebisi, and many more. This is an 18 and over event with no dogs allowed. Again, that's the Onion Music Festival, July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space, 30303 Northeast 10th Street in Washougal, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today's guest talks really about healing in terms of reckoning with meaning and values. Roy Scanton has written a book called We're Doomed, Now What? He's also authored Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, and he's written a lot about war. He used to be a soldier, And it's not exactly hopeful stuff, but in a certain way, it actually is. It's learning about kind of facing the idea that our world is pretty broken, and what do we do now? Tomorrow, actually, I wanted to let you know he'll be at Powell's on Hawthorne. That's 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard at 7:30 p.m., and he'll be discussing We're Doomed, Now What?, and he'll be joined in conversation by Omar El Akkad, author of American War. So, Roy, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me on, Stephanie.
Yeah, and you're just sort of doing a whirlwind tour right now.
That's right. We started out in, I had an event in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, and then we've been on a kind of driving tour of the West through Iowa City and Minneapolis and Missoula, Seattle, and now Salem. Tonight, Salem at the Book Bin, and then tomorrow night at Powell's.
Yeah, and probably in all this traveling, you've noticed how hot it's been.
It's been quite hot. It hasn't been as hot here as it has been in some places like Japan and with the fires burning in Norway and
or Greece.
But there are some wildfires here. I've heard
and floods in New England and hugely hot in the South. And that's kind of what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a planet where this is becoming more and more what we're calling the norm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's happening all over, and it's. You know, people are talking about it as the new normal, as if there's just, it's going to get a little warmer and then stop. But that's actually not what's going to happen. We've initiated feedback mechanisms in the global climate. What's happening now is a trajectory, right? It's warm and it's going to keep getting warmer. We're going to see more droughts, more wildfires, more heat waves. It's impossible for us to know exactly where it's going to stop. But given our business as usual sort of emissions trajectory, it's not going to stop until things get pretty bad.
And part of it, the heat that we're experiencing now is coming from CO2 that was launched into the atmosphere even decades ago.
That's right.
So
that's
this
right.
Kind of baked in kind of thing going on.
That's right. There's a pretty slow take up in the system. So the warming that we're experiencing now is coming from or is an effect of carbon dioxide that was emitted, like you're saying, decades ago. And it gets taken up in the oceans and then it gets taken up in the atmosphere. And then the warming effect sort of follows on later. So there's a lag, and I write about this in one of my essays in We Are Doomed. There's a lag between the wind and the whirlwind, right? There's a lag between the carbon dioxide we emit and the fires and the catastrophe that is emerging from that.
And then part of it, too, is there's one more aspect to it that I think is, and actually I interviewed a guy about this 9 years ago, and it was the first I'd ever heard of it, the methane that's going on.
Right.
And I thought, like, well, for sure we're going to do something. It's like we fixed the ozone hole, didn't we? And and the methane, could you talk a little about what's so scary about that? And 9 years later, it's still...
Right. So one of the likely feedback mechanisms that we're going to be encountering is the melting of methane clathrate hydrates that are frozen under the earth in permafrost in Siberia and Alaska and all around the Arctic Circle, and then also under the ocean, under the seafloor, say off the Siberian shelf, and under the Arctic Sea. And what happens is as the permafrost melts, as the sea warms up in the north, which is already happening, this frozen methane also melts and then releases into the atmosphere. You know, scientists are still figuring out right now how exactly that is going to work and how much methane gets absorbed by the ocean as it comes up from the seafloor. But there's clear evidence that permafrost and the seafloor are emitting methane now. And there's strong evidence that that's going to increase dramatically as the Arctic continues to warm. Now, what happens is that methane's many times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas.
It doesn't last as long, but
it's short-lived.
It's like 10 times, it's 20 times,
10 or
times.
20 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And so one of the worries is that as all this permafrost melts and the methane clathrate hydrates melt, you're going to get this burst, what they call the methane gun or the methane bomb. Yeah, you're going to get this burst of methane into the atmosphere, which is just going to supercharge global warming. And, you know, there's potential there to really shift the Earth into a kind of hothouse state that just makes it most of the Earth uninhabitable for human beings. You know, and there have been similar things in the paleoclimate record. And there's a real possibility of that happening now. Again, you know, the science is still figuring out how or when or what it might look like, but it could happen very quickly. One of the alarming things that you keep noticing if you pay attention to the climate science is that things are happening quicker than the models are predicting.
Right.
Over and over and over again. And so, and this is just one kind of more terrifying aspect of ways that things could go off the rails very quickly.
Yeah, in fact, I saw this article about, they call them pingos or something,
and
mounds of earth pushed up by melting permafrost. And,
right.
And Russian scientists, they found 7,000 in Russia. They think there might be 100,000. They're finding them now in Alaska.
Right.
This is all what you're talking about.
Right. And as well, there have been these sort of craters that have been opening up in Siberia in the last few years.
Just belching methane.
There are traces. Yeah, the evidence seems to suggest that it's these are methane belches coming out of Siberia. They're not really observing it happen. They just find the crater and then the methane traces.
Mm.
But it's alarming evidence of the possibility that the methane belch could actually be happening now.
You wrote in your book that climate change is a catastrophe, not a disaster. Could you talk about that?
Right. So that's I talk about that in my in this piece, Anthropocene City, which is about Houston and the city of Houston's efforts to address storm surge and hurricane defenses. And it's actually the philosopher Timothy Morton who makes that particular distinction between a catastrophe and a disaster. And the distinction he's making is that for him, a disaster is something that you watch. It's a spectacle that's happening to someone else that you see in the distance, whereas a catastrophe is something that you're a part of and that you're inside. And I think that's a really important distinction. I think Tim has a lot of really valuable things to say about understanding some of the phenomenological and philosophical aspects around climate change. And the point about that, right, this idea of the catastrophe versus the disaster, is that none of us are innocent, right? And you can't ever be, right? There's no action you can take that will make you, that will purify you of complicity in fossil-fueled capitalism, right?
This is our society.
This is our society. This is our world. And you just, there's, you know, basically no way to be a human being alive today that is going to absolve you of complicity in this problem. And so the question isn't, you know, who do we condemn necessarily, or who do we point a finger at, or even like what actions can we take to feel morally pure, but rather how do we make sense of our lives in this broken, ethically compromised world?
Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, it is about like fossil fuels. It's about meat production. I mean, those are the things driving it in a way. But there's also maybe in a certain way, like where we can look at why we're kind of even more complicit. There's like a kind of a cognitive dissonance that's going on. People aren't even willing to look at it in a way. There's a lack of political will. And basically, how do you sort of address some of that? I mean, how do you see that, you know, like what do we need to be doing about all of that?
Right. Well, so I will say, I'll back up a second and say that the title of the book, We're Doomed, Now What?
Yeah.
Is more, I don't mean to suggest that I have the answer. That you're gonna crack the book,
right,
and then you're gonna get to the now what.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's a 12-point plan to totally change everything. You know, I think there are imaginable futures where we are able to mitigate some of the effects of the climate change we've unleashed. But they often, to me, seem more fantastic than realistic.
Well, your solutions from the left and the right basically don't work, is how you're seeing it.
That's right. And it seems to me that in order really to address global climate change now, at this moment, when we're so far down the road, it would take basically a kind of global socialist revolution, right? There would have to be some kind of nationalization of major energy industries, centralized control of a lot of these, a lot of the industry and economy of the world, in order to be able to shift our contemporary global civilization off fossil fuels onto more sustainable energy. And, you know, the possibility of that, I mean, that's just, that feels like a dream vision, right? It doesn't feel like a real political program. And part of the reason is this, because, you know, we operate with this, many of us operate, you know, being born into this fossil fueled capitalist world and being born into a democratic republic and having certain progressive ideas, we feel like we have power. We can change things. We can do things. We can make things happen. But in so many ways, right, this world we're thrown into is one that has already decided many things for us, right? There's so many ways in which, we make our choices depending on what's available, right? We make our choices, you know, do we have the chicken or the tempeh, right? That's a choice depending on what's available around us. Mm-hmm. And so our entire world view is constrained by the limits and structures of global fossil-fueled capitalism. And it's incredibly difficult for us to act in a concerted collective way to live outside of our own lives.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear traffic from my house. And,
right.
And my first thought after I talked to that guy about the methane is, oh, we all have to just get out of our cars. And yet the reality is that's, you know, how do people, they have to go to work, you know,
right.
They have to drive their mother somewhere.
Right.
It's like, it's crazy. There's just breaking it seems so, yeah.
It seems in some way beyond our imagination or beyond our reach. Frederick Jameson, there's this famous quote that's been attributed to Frederick Jameson, right, recently, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
Right.
Although it seems more and more we might imagine those two things together. There is some, the place where I find not necessarily hope, but possibility is in the unknown, right? Or I talk about reflection, I talk about meditation, I talk about interruption in this book. Again and again, I think there's this possibility in, if we can interrupt our participation in the social cycles of desire and suffering, the social cycles of stress and reaction, right? If we can learn to center ourselves and let our consciousness exist, right? We can open a space where we're not reacting, where we're not just choosing from the available options, but where some new possibility might emerge.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I want to stop a minute here. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. I'm speaking with Roy Scranton, author of We're Doomed, Now What? And if you'd like to see him in person, he'll be at Powell's on Hawthorne tomorrow. That's Thursday at 7:30 p.m. to discuss his book in a conversation with Omar El Akkad, who's author of American War. And if you have any questions or comments, just give a call here to KBOO, 503-231-8187. There's so much in this. I mean, like, basically, yeah, you did talk about Buddhism in your book, and you talked about, and there's a poem actually by Pablo Neruda about, couldn't we just all stop?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, well, let's go to that now. But I also mm-hmm. want to talk about, your book has a lot of stuff about war,
it
so
does.
I want to get there too.
Okay. But
back to the little hopey bit.
Right.
So you yourself are a practicing Buddhist on some extent. So what does that have to contribute to this, do you think?
Right. So I will say, as I write in the essay in the book, I'm a bad Buddhist. I don't meditate as much as I should. I'm not vegetarian. I still, you know, choose to remain connected to the wheel of suffering
and you even had a kid.
And I even had a
kid.
Right, right. So I'm a bad Buddhist, but it is quite important for my thought, and not only my thought, but also my way of being in the world. Right. That's what is so meaningful to me about Buddhism as a spiritual practice, and it's consonant with other kinds of spiritual practice in other traditions, prayer and in a variety of forms. But what it is it's a practice. It's a way you train the body to be in the world that changes your thoughts and the way that you think about your existence in the world. And you know, what I find that it does for me, it does a lot of things, but the most important thing I find that it does for me is that it really, it opens up a space, right? It opens up a space in my relation to the world where I can be more attentive to what's happening around me and to the many rich connections between me and everything around me, but it also opens up a space in my behavior. Right, I'm not thinking in reaction. I'm not acting in reaction. I can reflect and engage a higher level of thought, and decide. You know, and have more freedom, if we want to use that word, to think about whether what I'm doing makes sense for me and the people around me.
In other words, someone cuts you off on the road, and instead of just, you know, oh, that jerk, you know, and let's race him or whatever, you're just like, oh, I don't need to go there.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, and it opens up that space where I'm not necessarily acting out of anger, right, and going down a path that, you know, winds up putting me in a place where I'm like having a shouting match with somebody on the side of the road or something like that. You know, but it's also, but it's not necessarily pacifist either, right? It's there are times when one needs to act assertively, right? Mm-hmm. Or times when one needs to act with intention. There are people in the world who, you know, sometimes want to hurt you, and you know, you can act there, but again, that Buddhist space, that Zen space, that meditative space, opens up a space for you to make those decisions wisely and tactically, right, and with efficaciousness, rather than angrily and crudely and in reaction.
And another thing about it for me is this, that it also, a lot of Buddhist meditation can be looking at really what is, and one of the things that is that we're here and we're gone. I mean, that reality right. is that nobody lives forever. And in a certain way, you begin to face your own death.
Right,
and
absolutely.
It seems like also in your book, you're asking individuals to do that, but society as a whole to do that. That in a certain way, the society needs to sort of come to terms with the fact that it may not be around forever. In fact, I just saw this neat thing that they're speculating maybe we've never found life in outer space, because any civilization that gets to the point where ours is eventually just burns itself out.
Right. That's an interesting, hypothesis. And that's but your point about Buddhism bringing out the transience of our life is absolutely on point. And that's, you know, I talked about that in my previous book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, and I talk about it in this one as well, the necessity of facing our own transience, right? The transience of the self, our individual mortality, and facing the limits, the mortality of our civilization. This is a, you know, and really, because that's where, you know, we live in these bodies, but we have these movies playing right in our head, these images, these ideas of how things are supposed to be and how things are supposed to go, and these stories about you can do anything you want, and America's, you know, going to live forever, and everything's going to be amazing. But you know, the reality is we're these animals who have built this complicated society, and it's all going to go away at some point, right? Because that's what happens, right? That's just how nature works. But so if we can attend to that, if you can slow down, right, and open up that space, if you can develop that kind of slow attention that meditation practice cultivates, you can confront that mortality. And that even the idea of the civilization going away, not by denying it, and not by ignoring it, and not by not feeling the grief, but by feeling the grief, and then realizing that grief comes from the rich connections you right. have today.
The intense caring about it, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the richness of our life today. The richness of our existence right now as humans together, making our lives together in this world, is why it's sad and scary to think about it all going away. And so accepting that transience actually, I think, allows us to open up into the richness of our connected existence now.
Which is maybe what allowed you to become a father.
Yeah, I think it was definitely part of it. Yeah, the idea, you know, I didn't,
how old is your daughter now?
She's, about 14 months now.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Just a year.
Yeah. She's walking and, Yeah, she's incredible. She's picking her own clothes now. She's starting to talk.
Well, you wrote about, you know, this the tears of joy and then the tears of sorrow that you experienced when she was just born.
That's right. It was a quite emotional moment. And my partner, my wife, was in labor for 27 hours, something like that. The last part was especially difficult because the baby was turned in a funny way. But then the baby came out, and there's, you know, I mean, all parents know this moment, this intense wave of joy and relief and amazement that passes through you, this new life emerging into the world. It's a kind of religious moment, it feels like. And then, as I write about in Raising a Daughter in a Doomed World in the book, you know, then a few minutes later, holding her, you know, I just looked out. I live in Indiana, in northern Indiana, in a kind of burned out Rust Belt town that fell on hard times when the Studebaker plant closed in the 60s and has never quite got back on its feet. And, you know, I just looked out at the strip malls and the concrete and the just this world and thought about all these things, the heat waves, the droughts, the climate change, all the things that we're looking at over the next few decades. And I didn't know, like, I had to apologize to my daughter for bringing her into this world, because her future is going to be a difficult one, right? Her life is going to be challenged and constrained and difficult in countless ways. Yet I don't regret
doing it
for a moment, right? I don't regret that choice because this is human life, right? We keep going, right? We keep trying to keep going. We keep trying to make our lives together in meaningful ways. And human beings have survived through countless miserable situations and still had rich and meaningful lives. So there's this intense emotional, you know, these intense emotions coming around to that. But at the same time, I can't give up on the idea of human life and on keeping going.
So
right?
We're doomed, but there's still hope.
We're doomed, but there's still hope to live meaningful lives.
Meaningful lives, right? Which is
a
big part of what your book talks about.
Right.
And really briefly, you mentioned to me just before we went on air, though, that you've been getting some kind of weird reactions to talking about your daughter in this way and talking about your hopes for her future. Could you just briefly mention what that was?
Right. That's a week ago Monday, I published an excerpt from that essay retitled Raising a Child in a Doomed World in the New York Times philosophy series The Stone, and it really I wasn't sure how it would be received, if anyone would even read it. You never know with these sorts of things. And I was astounded by the sort of intense wave of vicious attacks that the piece inspired. It inspired a range of responses. A lot of people emailed or tweeted or let me know in various ways, or commented on the Times page that the piece had articulated feelings they'd been having, that it meant a lot to them to hear these things said in public, that they were glad to see it, and that this was important to them. But then on the other hand, there were a range of attacks against me personally, against attacking my masculinity, attacking, telling me I should commit suicide, telling me the state should take my daughter away, because I had articulated this fear, and expressed emotions about being sad, that our world is changing and that climate change is real. I mean, there were also, you know, a range of attacks by some professional climate denialists, and then some other people on the right wing, like Ben Shapiro, who attacked me in Newsweek with this totally specious and fairly ignorant piece about how everything's fine. Climate change really isn't a problem, and society and the things have never been better in the world. And you know, there is a certain point in that human, by numerous measures, right? Human life is incredible right now compared to how it's been in the past. We have so much wealth and so much technology that lifespan is quite long. Standard of living is quite high. There are all these measures that, in some ways, right, life never has been better, right? And yet, it's that very wealth, right? It's that very productivity as humans, right? The number of humans and so on that's destroying us. Not because of some moral reason, but simply that
just bugs in a petri dish multiplying.
Right, bugs in a petri dish. But we've surpass the boundary conditions for human life on Earth in numerous ways, not least of which is that all that wealth comes from the cheap energy we've been extracting from the Earth and burning, and then that turns into waste carbon in the atmosphere, which is heating the planet. Right. Like, it's really simple science, and it's not a moral question at that level, right?
Right.
It's just, you know, we've burned too much carbon and we haven't fixed it, and that's gonna overheat the planet and destabilize and probably destroy civilization as we know it.
Or
so,
a lot of us, anyway.
And a lot of us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these kinds of attacks from people on the right, I'm not, you know, I've been trying to figure out where some of this comes from. And I'm sure in some cases it's people blinded by their own privilege. I'm sure in other cases it's people who want to believe things are going to be okay, right? Like Naomi Klein makes this point in
Desperately.
In This Changes Everything. She says people who are invested materially in carbon-fueled capitalism are going to be invested ideologically in opposing the idea that climate change is real. Because if you actually admit the truth of climate change, then
that's the title of her book.
Right.
This
then it
changes
everything.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So,
you know, there may be some kind of ideological commitment there. But then as well, I think more and more, as we've seen with Exxon, as may be the case with some people out in Silicon Valley and others, I think more and more, I think a lot of these fervent right-wing people are recognizing that things are happening, right?
It's hot.
it's hot. And there are climate refugees and, you know, there's all this stuff is happening. The evidence is blaring. It's glaring in your face. And I think sometimes they're just lying because they think that if they continue to lie to us, somehow that's going to help them get on a lifeboat. That's going to help them, you know, hide out
in the
fortress.
They'll be rich enough to move to New Zealand or move
exactly,
to Mars.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And so I think for some of these people, there's a deep intellectual bad faith and an explicit effort to try to confuse and distract people because they think as long as people can stay confused and distracted, they can run off with the loot. With the loot.
Yeah. Okay, I want to just pause a minute again. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. I'm talking with Roy Scranton, who wrote, "We're Doomed, Now What?" Tomorrow at 7:30, he'll be at Powell's on Hawthorne, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne, and he'll be joined by Omar El Akkad, who wrote American War. And right now, if you'd like to talk with us, you can call KBOO 503-231-8187. There's so much here, and what your book was also, but I want to get to this stuff about war a little bit
Sure.
before we get, and then I definitely want to get to meaning again.
Right.
But you grew up in Oregon.
That's right.
You were poor.
That's right.
You tried to go to college. You couldn't afford it. You had to drop out.
Right.
You ended up becoming a soldier and eventually even a soldier in Iraq, partly to pay for college and for other reasons as well, basically, right?
Right.
And you talk about war in the book because you've actually experienced it. And how does war, what's the link here with war, essays on war and climate change? What's the link? How do they all play into each other?
Right, right. There's a couple things. And I just want to say it's true. I grew up here in Oregon. I graduated North Salem from North Salem High School in 1994.
You've lived in Portland even.
I've lived in Portland.
And now you're a professor at Notre Dame after having gone to Princeton because you could afford college.
Right, right, with the GI Bill. Yeah, so the connection between war and climate change is there are a few major ways that these ideas and essays connect in my thinking, in the world, and in this book. One way is that climate change creates conflict, right? Climate change is going to drive conflict all over the world. And so, you know, things like the Syrian civil war, right? Many people have argued, I think convincingly, that that's maybe our first climate change war. The movement of farmers into cities in Syria, you know, 8 years ago or around there, precipitated by drought in Syria, probably because of climate change, was one of the drivers of what then became the civil war. And so that's just one example, and there are numerous.
Bangladesh has problems, yeah.
Right, right, all over. We're going to see more and more conflict driven by climate change and these sort of second-order effects. And so we need to be thinking about the two together, I think. But another major way that they go together is this question of how we make meaning in the world. And oftentimes we like to think of war as as something that exists outside of society or exists outside of civilization. It's this kind of metaphysical force that comes down and it comes out of the sky as on September 11th and and demands some kind of response. But in fact,
something like a natural thing, like a storm.
It's
almost
like a natural disaster,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in fact, it's not, right? War is something that humans do. It's a way that we make meaning in the world, right? It's a political choice, but even more than that, it's a set of cultural practices and constructions that is a way that we tell ourselves who we are. And several of the pieces in the book deal with that, especially around this sort of American tradition of a narrative of victimization and recovery through violence, right? A narrative of redemption through violence. And Richard Slotkin wrote the sort of the foundational books about this tradition, which goes back to the Indian Wars in the 17th century, right? And this sort of it's this originary myth about American identity.
Sort of like a John Wayne thing? Almost?
It's sort of like a John Wayne thing. We're just going along doing our business, and then we're attacked. Somebody attacks us, and then we have to take on the characteristics of that bad guy, right, in order to destroy them.
Which is kind of what played out with 9/11 and the Twin Tower attack.
Precisely, right? We had to go to the dark side, right, is what Dick Cheney said in order to win this war. You know, and that you can see that happening again and again in American culture. And then what happens, then there's this process of sort of purification or expurgation that happens afterward when the veteran then as a culture we see, oh, they've been contaminated by this violence. They've been contaminated by this encounter with the other. Now they have to go through this, now they've been traumatized. Mm-hmm. So now they have to testify to that trauma in order to sort of purify both themselves and the nation, right? And so there's this wounding and then reactive violence and then this kind of purification process that happens. And I talk about that in my book, and it's these are ways that we make meaning together, right, as a culture. We choose certain narratives. We listen to certain narratives. We believe certain narratives, sometimes without question, without examination. That holds true both for war and with regards to climate change, right? You know, and there's countless resonances at this level, from the idea that, you know, war is a natural disaster to some recognition that, you know, a hurricane is no longer a natural disaster, right? It's a disaster brought about in some sense by human action. And so one of the main things when we get to the now what question, one of the main things I'm sort of advocating is this meditative practice, is this idea of reflection and opening up space for new possibilities to emerge. But another thing that I think we need to remember and to talk about and to foreground again and again is the idea that human meaning in this world is made by humans,
mm-hmm.
right? And there are tendencies toward certain kinds of meaning production that seem, if not hardwired, at least deeply wired, right? That you can see in cultures all over the world again and again certain practices and certain tendencies cropping up, from incest taboos to, you know, taboos on murder and certain kinds of ways of organizing behavior. You can see in the work of structural anthropologists like Claude Lévi-Strauss. But at the same time, given these sort of basic structures, sort of like, if you will, like a Chomskyan generative grammar for culture, right? There's the potential for incredible amounts, incredible variety, right, of choices. We can organize our culture together, not quite in any way we want, but with tremendous freedom, right? There's tremendous opportunity to change the way things mean, to change what means, to change where our values are.
Right.
And it's not, you know, it's not the work of a day. It's not the work maybe even of a lifetime. It will take generations of work in response to changing environmental conditions and so on and so on. But, you know, when we think, you know, part of who I'm talking to is fellow writers and artists and thinkers. And part of what I want to say is that we need to be thinking into the future, right? We can't just react to what's happening now. If we're committed to making meaning in language and in culture, right, we need to be trying to imagine where that meaning is going to emerge in this very different world created by climate change.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult problem. It's impossible to imagine in advance what the future will need, right? It's impossible to imagine in advance how we will reorganize life in this new earth. But I feel like it seems to me that's the obligation of thinkers and artists today is to try to get there, to
yeah.
sort of...
And you see it in science fiction, Ursula
right.
Le Guin, maybe?
Absolutely.
She had some beautiful visions of
right.
how the world could be.
Right.
You know, or... Yeah, there are these potentials and possibilities if we expand our... And actually, the show I did last month, a fellow wrote a book about spiritual revelation, quantum physics, and
mm-hmm.
spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And that we could actually... If we could get out of kind of a Newtonian way of thinking about things and get more into a kind of quantum way of thinking things, he's saying we could transform our reality.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of different ways we could start seeing how things could be, you know.
Right.
But soldiers especially, and then actually like what I sort of got going back to your whole thing about the war was that we don't create war as a natural, like that you were sort of stuck in Iraq, that eventually you felt sort of ripped off, as that you'd become an agent for people who are actually profiting off war, which is again like profiting off climate change. And
right.
that somehow we have to get, the wrong people seem to be in charge right now.
Right. And I suppose that's another way that war and climate change are similar, is that, you know, they're invested with meaning in all kinds of ways. War is sacred in certain ways, and when we talk about climate change, it has this kind of spiritual or religious aspect to it in relation to sort of traditional modes of environmentalism. And at the same time, there are these people who are just going to seek to profit from it, right? People making money off war, people making money off climate change, people making money off sacred human beliefs, right? Like,
right.
And it's we've given them the keys to the castle, right? They run things, and maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe they should. Maybe we should take their keys away.
Right. And so then you wrote basically then that there's a myth. Another thing that a part of this was a gap between the myth of violence and the truth of war, and so that goes with again this idea that we make meaning out of war in a way. Soldiers make meaning out of war. It matters to them that they're soldiers.
Right.
You know, and we become like, you know, those bad, terrible Iraqis and these wonderful soldiers or these wonderful Americans trying to make democracy over there. It's like, how, and then it you talk about it even spreading over into this kind of military violence into our police and how mm-hmm. we end up doing the same thing as police to, you know, poor people or black people.
Right. Yeah. These are thoughts that I sort of elaborate in more length in some of the essays in the book, particularly The Fantasy of American Violence and The Trauma Hero and other essays. Part of how the way we understand ourselves as a people is through acts of sacrifice, right? Through who we decide who's a sacrificial figure and who isn't.
Yeah, I like that tragedy comes from sacrificing a goat in
that's
Greek
right.
language.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tragic theater emerges out of this religious ritual of sacrificing a goat, a kind of scapegoat figure who, right, they take on the sins of the people in order to expurgate them, in order to purify ourselves morally. And that's one of the roles of the contemporary veteran in American society, is to take on the sins of America, first to act out American violence, then to take on the sins of the whole society, right, in terms of that violence through their trauma, right? So then they're responsible for purifying themselves and expurgating that sin.
And we just are the people who thank you for your service.
right. That's why we have to thank them for their service,
right.
Is because they have not only killed for us, but then they also, right, suffer the guilt of that. They suffer that blood guilt for us.
Right.
And our investment in that drama allows us to forget about the people they killed, right?
Yes.
That's one of the major things happening there, yes. Is that our investment in that trauma hero narrative allows us to completely forget about the Iraqis or the Afghan people that were killed in this violence. Wonderful.
Again, it's a kind of denialism.
It's a kind of denialism, yeah. Right. Act it out. It's a wonderful little trick we play.
Just to let you know again, I'm speaking here at KBOO Portland with Roy Scranton. He's here with us on the Recovery Zone. Roy is author of We're Doomed, Now What? You can call in with your questions or comments, 503-231-8187. And to see Roy in person, head over to Powell's on Hawthorne tomorrow evening. He'll be there at 7:30 in conversation with the author of American War, Omar El Akkad. Well, we really have to start talking about now what again. A lot of this, it's like there's these incredible contradictions in our society. There's this mm-hmm. incredible ignoring going on, denialism.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of what you talk about is that we need, besides just passing those hurdles, is to start looking at, and as you alluded to just earlier, what kind of meaning are we really going to make out of our lives? And that we do have a choice of the kind of meaning. I don't have to make my life meaningful by being a soldier. I can make it meaningful by trying to interview people on KBOO.
Right.
You know, it's like, what is the meaning to a life, and how do we create that? And why is that so important in all of this?
Right. And it's, I mean, it's an impossibly
huge,
large and yeah. abstract question, right?
Yeah.
But I think there's space, I think there's a space there that we can open up and work in to imagine a new possibility. You know, and let me say this, though. I mean, this isn't, what I'm talking about is not something that's going to save us, right?
Right.
It's not something that's going to save this civilization.
In a way, it could save our souls through it, though, somehow. Is
right.
How I hear it.
I think what it might be able to save is
some of us
and some continuation of human meaning, right?
Your daughter might make it.
My daughter might make it. And what's more is that we might be able to figure out how to make this transition to a new world in a less awful way, right, than what's probably going to happen, right? We can mitigate. We can do tikkun olam. We can do healing, right, in this world. We can try to mitigate and try to connect and try to do what healing we can as we go through this transition to a new climate change world, rather than the tendencies that we tend to fall, you know, these modes of thinking and modes of making meaning that we tend to fall back on, right, which are scapegoating and violence and war, right?
And accumulation and barricading ourselves.
Right, but very important, you know, that we pick an enemy, right? This is
right.
This is one of the most atavistic and you know, recurring ways humans deal with problems is they blame somebody, they pick an enemy, they pick a scapegoat, and they pile like all their confusion and sorrow and anger onto that one person. And that one person, you know, it may be the Chinese, it may be Arabs, it may be Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking, that might be me doing
well,
that.
Right. You know, I think it's fascinating to think about the Silicon Valley entrepreneur Peter Thiel is a very interesting thinker, and he's really into this guy René Girard, who is a very important French philosopher of sacrifice and scapegoating. And I suspect, and Thiel was... notably, he was one of the few Silicon Valley, big Silicon Valley people who supported Donald Trump. But I suspect part of the reason he actually supported Trump was because he sees Trump as a scapegoat for the anxiety, fear, and anger of American working classes and American liberals and progressives, right? It's someone who can be a focus for our emotions, right? While Thiel builds his fortress in New Zealand, right?
Yeah.
So we need to think about this in deep ways. How do we back off from these sort of traditional, sort of atavistic modes of reaction? How do we back off from scapegoating? How do we back off from naming an enemy and moving into violence? How do we create a space for reflection and a different choice
yeah.
to make?
Yeah, that's really the question. How do we do that? You know, is it just meditating? Is it gathering together? And like a lot of what I got from your book is that we need to be, you know, like I was thinking like, okay, I go to a party, I start talking about we're doomed, I become Debbie Downer.
Mm-hmm.
But so I don't do that, basically. And mm-hmm. I think in a lot of situations, we're not talking about what's real. And in a certain way, what you're asking us to do is to start talking to each other, to start really discussing some of this real stuff.
That's absolutely right. And to start discussing it and to not flee from the difficult emotions that emerge, the
right.
grief and the guilt and the anger. you know, to sit with those. In some ways, I think my advice might reduce to the slogan, don't just do something, sit there, right? Let's make more space where we can sit and understand what's happening and how it's affecting us and talk about that with each other. Then I think we can begin to discover new ways of doing it, new ways of being and new ways of organizing our life in this world. But it's not going to come from just, reacting to the latest outrage or just waving another flag.
Right. And it's almost as if we could imagine, like, say, politicians or news people, you know, talking to us. Well, we just had another drought in Texas or a wildfire in California because we put so much more CO2 in the atmosphere. This is making me very sad. How are you feeling out there, audience?
Right. You know? That would be different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We don't talk, you know, in our media or, you know, publicly really about things the way they really are happening inside of our hearts, you know.
That's right. And then one of the problems that comes up there is this disjunct, right? This increasing disjunct between the way we believe things are supposed to be and then the way that they actually are, right?
Yeah.
We can believe that there's this stable system that is able to absorb everything and then feed it back to us in a calm and normal way. Meanwhile, the world is changing under our feet.
Right.
And we need to step back from this investment in these sort of false and mythic narratives and really, really connect to where we are right now.
And finally, you talk about that we must live ethically in a broken world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that be willing to live again, you were saying that you can't be pure exactly, but you can be ethical. And what did you mean by that?
What I mean by that is a recognition, first of all, a recognition that one is never an independent agent. One is never self-reliant. One is always connected to and dependent on countless people and responsible to countless people, and not just people, but natural forces and the animal life that we live within and around. You know, from our gut flora in the bacteria that make up
right.
our body to the salmon that we eat, or the birds that live off our refuse, right? We're locked inevitably, essentially from the beginning in the natural world. That's what we are. We're part of the universe, just this emergent moment of consciousness in the universe. And that, and the recognition that this emergent moment of consciousness passes is for me the beginning of ethics, right? And that's the beginning of an ethical life, because there's no way to live in this world without causing suffering. Yet we can work to limit that and decrease it and to do what healing we can and to help build that connection where we can. And that's an ethical project.
It's sort of like a meaningful life. Like sometimes you hear do no harm, which is impossible.
That's right.
But to my life could be meaningful in terms of doing less harm.
That's
if
right.
I could just constantly be thinking, well, what would be the less harmful thing here?
Right. What would be the less harmful thing? And as well, how can I connect us?
Yeah, connection and, yeah, exactly.
That's right.
So anyway, I just want to let listeners know you've been listening to Roy Scranton. He's the author of Scranton. Roy Scranton, author of We're Doomed, Now What? You can also visit with him tomorrow at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne, where he'll be joined in conversation with Omar El Akkad, author of American War. Again, that's tomorrow, Thursday, July 26th at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Stephanie Potter, and I want to thank Derek Crooks for his fine engineering, and thank you for listening and supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center in Portland. The Rosewood Health Fair will provide health and wellness resources to the community, along with sports, physicals, and immunizations for children. There will be food, games, prizes, and a variety of community resources for families. Again, that's Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center, 8935 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Well, welcome again to another edition of Jazz Lives. And here we go. On the Boo Station.